Hi, and welcome back to the Business of Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Tara Humphrey. I run an award-winning healthcare consultancy specialising in supporting primary care networks. I'm a facilitator. I am a mum of three. I have an MBA, and I would class myself as a bit of an adventurer. And I absolutely love all things business, all things leadership, all things management. So I created this podcast for clinical and non-clinical colleagues working in the field of health and care, and for those of you looking to develop your leadership skills. Every week we release an episode which focuses on the hard and soft skills required to lead in this increasingly complex environment as we move to delivering more integrated care. So let's jump into this week's episode. I think that people should know about this. I think it's really, really, really important. The NHS is the biggest employer. This is happening all the time.
And that's when we founded our campaign organisation, Surviving in Scrubs.
Hey, Chelsea, thank you so much for joining me today on the Business of Healthcare podcast. How are you doing?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm fine, yeah.
So I came across you and your co-founder on Twitter a few weeks ago, and I think it was Dr. Farah Jamil, who's been on the podcast, shared your report, Surviving Healthcare Sexism and Sexual Violence in the Healthcare Workforce. Mm-hmm. And I clicked on it, even though the title tells me what's going to be in it. When I was reading through it, kind of had to like stop what I was doing. I was just gobsmacked and really, really, really sad. And I just thought that I think that people should know about this report. I think it's really, really, really important. And that the NHS is the biggest employer. This is happening all the time. So could you share a little bit about yourself, a little bit about what you do, and then what led you down this path to writing this report?
Yeah, sure. So clinically, I work as emergency medicine registrar up in the Merseyside region, though I am currently on maternity leave.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Oh, I'm about to go back to work, not looking forward to it. Anyway, I had an experience. I've had multiple experiences of sexism within work, and unfortunately, the more kind of violent end of the spectrum as well. But I had a particular incident back in 2018 where I was, without going into specifics, I was humiliated in a very gendered way in front of a full MDT. And this is pre-COVID. So this is when like there were 30 people sardined into a small MDT room. And that was sort of like my eureka moment of like, oh, I've just experienced sexism and misogyny. And then started talking to my colleagues, both more senior, more junior than myself, about their experiences. And I naively at the time thought, oh, well, this does happen quite a lot. It's quite normalized. Maybe this is just part and parcel of training. I'll become a consultant and then it'll stop. Which was very naive of me, because I then spoke to some female consultants who I had a really good relationship with, and they were like, oh, no, this still happens. This happens all the time. So then that led to me doing a piece of work with the BMA called the Sexism in Medicine Survey. So that was published in August 21. Just to kind of briefly outline that, that survey went out to doctors, so BMA and non-BMA members. We got 2,500 respondents. And the kind of headline news on that was that 91% of female doctors had experienced sexism within those 2 years prior to that report going out. And at that time, there was a fair bit of media attention and there was quite a lot of conversations being had. It was around the time that the article about sexual assault in surgery came out. And then I really felt like something was happening and then nothing happened. And within this time, the co-founder, my friend and colleague, Becky Cox, got in contact with me and we were talking via Zoom a few times. And then we finally met in person in Birmingham. And that's when Becky and I got together and thought, well, what could we do? And that's when we founded our campaign organization, Surviving in Scrubs. Surviving in Scrubs, at our core, is a website, survivinginscrubs.co.uk, where anyone who works in healthcare, whether you be doctors, nurses, physios, OTs, admin staff, whoever working in healthcare, can anonymously submit their experiences of sexism, misogyny, sexual harassment, and sexual assault within the healthcare workplace onto our website. We've gathered a fairly decent sized collected narrative there now. So we've got over 200 stories on there, some being a few sentences, some being just pages, pages long, of what is happening out there in terms of these attitudes and behaviours within healthcare. It's pretty grim reading, but that's accumulated in us compiling this report, the Surviving Healthcare Report, where we've analysed 150 of those stories. Behind the scenes, we've got some demographic data in terms of who the professions are, what level of seniority there is. But I think the powerful thing is the qualitative data that's looking at the themes that transcend all of these experiences. That's the report that we published a few weeks ago. You know, it's a piece of work we're really proud of, but unfortunately, it is pretty grim reading.
What's been the response so far?
We had a decent amount of mainstream media attention. We've been interviewed by Times, had some conversations with Guardian, Independent, BBC as well. And we've got ongoing media links in mainstream media, which has been predominantly supportive of what we're doing. We already, through the Surviving and Scrubs organisation, we already have quite a lot of links with the GMC, a few of the Royal Colleges, BMA and NHS England as well. And they've been very supportive as well. A few of them have written and published supportive statements about the report. Obviously, very distressed about what we've discovered, but there is support for hopefully implementing change going forward.
When you said you thought something was starting to happen, but then it didn't. What is the thing that you wanted to happen?
I think at the time, it was the fact that all of a sudden, what is essentially the worst kept secret within healthcare? This culture of sexism, misogyny. We all know that it happens. We've all heard of or worked with a consultant who can't be left alone with female colleagues. We know that there's someone who always makes inappropriate comments. We know these behaviours exist, and it's been normalised for so long because healthcare is not exempt from the patriarchal society in which we live and have survived as a culture for thousands and thousands of years. So we all know that it happens, but it had never been talked about. And then that BMA report came out and people started talking about it. I found it bizarre that so many people were surprised about the fact that these behaviours, these statistics had been found. But I suspect that's because that was my normality and I just probably my bias with it. But there was media attention. There were, you know, key stakeholders, i.e. the Royal College of Surgeons, the BMA, talking about this, saying they wanted to do something about this. But then those big organisations have got multiple priorities and things took priority at that time. Not to say that there wasn't work being done, but it wasn't necessarily going at the speed that it had done leading up until publishing of the report, if that makes sense.
And what's the strategy moving forwards?
In terms of Surviving and Scrubs as an organisation, basically behind the scenes, we do have some volunteers, but it is mainly myself and Becky that are out and about having meetings, doing training and education events. We're also campaigning for change on a huge, huge scale. So we've got a lot of things we want to accomplish. And a lot of things actually that we have accomplished. We've only been going for about 18 months and we've done some pretty impressive things actually. We were at Parliament a few weeks ago talking to the Women and Equality Select Committee. We've been knocking on the door of 10 Downing Street. We've been to national and international conferences telling people about what's going on. So we have accomplished a lot, but unfortunately there's a long way to go. In terms of key strategies, I think our main priority at the moment is highlighting what's going on. So this being speaking events, whether that be podcasts like this or formal conferences, interviews, but also we offer training and education events. We are not funded. Becky and I are doing this completely off our own back. So in order for us to be a sustainable organisation, we now offer training packages in terms of highlighting what is going on, what the prevalence and incidence is out there at the moment, but also what individuals can do, whether that be active bystander training or training for men to be allies, but then also organisational priorities as well in terms of policies, how managers and leaders can bring about change in this area. So whether that be how they deal with first disclosures, how they react to being told about these incidences occurring out clinically. So that's our main priority at the moment. So at the minute, it's all face-to-face or virtually face-to-face on Teams, Zooms, etc. But we've also got plans to do some formal webinars as well. So that's kind of one mainstream. And then another main priority of ours is further research. So we've obviously compiled our report, but we've got plans to delve a bit deeper into the kind of the research area of this, whilst also advocating for survivors of this. So yeah, we're pretty busy.
And you're having a baby.
Well, I said I just had one. She's 9 months old. I'm going to be going back to work in about 6 weeks' time. So Becky and I will be both working full time whilst doing this, whilst doing all the other things that one has to do.
Do you want to be doing all of the things?
Yeah, I do. It's a very soul-searching question. I've done a lot of them. I think now that I'm coming back up to going back to clinical work, it's made me really reassess my priorities. And obviously, I now have a daughter, so she is number one. I'm going back less than full time, which enables me to kind of juggle home life and work life a bit better. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm terrible at getting the balance right. I've always been a workaholic, and maternity leave was no different. She's my first and probably my only. I had this very stupid thought that, oh, yeah, no, like if I'm not working, then I'll have 48 hours free a week so I can do X, Y, and Z. Yeah, of course, that's exactly how a newborn baby works, isn't it?
Yes, for 48 hours, they don't need anything.
Yeah, exactly. No, they'll sleep. They sleep all the time. No, they don't. No, they don't. For example, I was doing a master's in health professions education with UCL. That's on hold for now. I'll dip back into that when I have capacity. Surviving in Scrubs and this kind of advocacy, policy, education work, it's the kind of stuff that lights my fire. I adore clinical medicine. I adore A&E. There's got to be some of us out there that love it, because otherwise, where would we be? But I'm aware that pure clinical emergency medicine isn't sustainable for me as an individual. So I need something that flexes those other muscles and lights those other fires in me. And surviving in Scrubs does exactly that.
How do you feel about the spotlight on you, or a brighter spotlight is on you than before, now the report's come out?
I'll be honest, I haven't really thought about it. I haven't really thought about it. Becky and I are a really good team. We've got different strengths, different weaknesses, but we work together really well. And when it comes to supporting each other with the stresses of this role, founders of a nonprofit organization, we're very good at looking after each other. So if I am particularly stressed 1 week, or there's other parts of my life that have to take over, Becky's very good at supporting me and vice versa. So I think our teamwork is something that definitely helps with all those things.
The Business of Healthcare podcast is brought to you proudly in partnership with 10,000 Donors and their Gob for Good campaign. Gob for Good is all about getting as many people as possible to join the stem cell registry. Only 3% of the UK are registered to be stem cell donors, and only 0.4% of the global population. If you or a loved one have the devastating news that you have been diagnosed with a blood cancer, the chances of you finding your blood stem cell match is significantly reduced if you have a minority ethnic heritage. It is really, really simple. All you need to do is click into the show notes or visit the Gob for Good website at gobforgood.com and get yourself signed up to the registry. You could one day receive that life-saving call, or one day you may need that life-saving call. Now, let's jump back into this week's episode.
So before we press record, I shared my really tiny experience of sexism and kind of inappropriate language when I was at the NHS Confederation conference and I was with my peers, and someone said to me, it was after the event, oh, did you know so-and-so said you and so-and-so looked like a couple of prostitutes? And I was obviously really surprised, because I don't feel like I'd ever give off that vibe ever. Like, I'm really, unless I've got no self-awareness. So I phoned up the person and said, I hear that you said that I look like a prostitute. Can you help me explain what about what I was wearing that would make you think that? And he said, No. Sorry you feel that way. No. And then I wrote about it in my newsletter. And I did think, it's interesting. Some people said to me, you're so brave. so brave. But I just thought, no, you don't say that. And then you think, you're not going to say anything. This is ridiculous. And we were talking about the culture of tolerance. So in that moment, the people that heard it didn't say anything. And I'm sure it's not acceptable, but we've all been in situations where someone has said something and you've kind of gone like, what? But you've not said anything, or you've laughed, but you didn't think it was funny. You know, like sometimes you react in ways that don't really match how you are feeling at the time.
Yeah.
And I think this culture of tolerance around making comments about people's language or their sexual orientation or their appearance. What have you learned about this culture of tolerance and how do we break it?
I've learned that it's absolutely everywhere. I don't think any part of healthcare is exempt from it. I suspect there's areas, whether that be geographically or due to specialties, that are more tolerant than others. But in terms of breaking it, I think the thing that we can all do on an individual level is just keep talking about these issues. And I think having this conversation out in the open enables people to either call out behaviours at the time, for example, said an inappropriate comment, pull them to one side and say, just so you know, that wasn't okay. And hopefully it enables people who say the comments, it enables them to kind of realize that that joke, quote unquote joke, didn't land well. I wonder why it didn't land well. Oh, okay, maybe I've done something wrong there. And obviously there'll be people that are so far gone in their attitudes and their beliefs that they won't be affected by these things. But even if you can just start chipping away at some people, at some beliefs, some attitudes, then, you know, you're making things a bit better. And that's better than doing nothing altogether.
I suppose the assumption is that this happens mainly to women.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that it's a wrong assumption. In your report, you did share some stories of male colleagues. And I think that's important to share because I think that there is, you know, like there's different rules, isn't there, that we think that we abide by. So we can say this to women. It's like we can't say that to a woman, but we could say that to a man. And that's a joke. Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about your findings when it comes to the experiences of male colleagues?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is that, yes, this does happen to men, but it is a minority. This does happen to women a lot more than it does happen to men. However, we do know that from the report that we've compiled on our website generally, we do have some stories that have been submitted by men. They've spoken about how, particularly when it comes to nurses, so though the medical workforce is near enough 50-50, slightly more female juniors coming through now, the nursing workforce is about 90% female compared to 10% male. And that seems to be an environment that can be uncomfortable for men. So what's described in one of the stories is almost like a pack mentality of a group of women towards the one male. So it's being aware of these things. And just because someone is a man or a woman, it can affect anyone. And then also to add into that, we don't have enough data, unfortunately, in the case studies that we have on our website. But it's also to be aware of the intersectionality of this, the aspect of this. So the other protected characteristics, whether that be race, ethnicity, sexuality, ability, disabilities as well. That's an area that we are keen to do more research in because we suspect that there's probably almost kind of a double or a triple discrimination with the protected characteristics as well.
Did you find any themes in regards to when incidents happened and when people were brave enough to speak up, then what happened?
Yeah, we did see some themes. Long story short, either nothing happened or the response wasn't good enough. So we've talked already about this culture of tolerance, and that also affects what happens after a report has been disclosed. So we've heard of people who do tell, say their supervisors, HR, line managers, whoever they disclose to, being told to not make a fuss, being told that there's nothing that can be done, or it does get to the point of an investigation, either internally at a trust or maybe even with a regulator. There's been bias in that, and the people who are doing the investigating aren't independent of that work environment. So we know from the data that most perpetrators, I think about 70% of the stories say that consultants were the perpetrator. So often in that doctor kind of hierarchy, you would then report an incident to your supervisor, who's also a consultant. So these consultants are then working closely together, they're friends, you as a junior doctor might then be moving on. So there's a real incentive for that department to either brush it under the carpet or to dismiss it, or, you know, dismiss what is being said and to make it out that the reporter is the one with the problem. So we've seen that. Also, with talking to people that just come and talk to us generally, we hear a lot about how there seems to be a lack of communication at a trust level versus a GMC level, for example, or a regulator level. So a lot of instances that should go to the regulator don't get reported, and a lot of issues that don't really reach the threshold of GMC investigation get told to the GMC. So that there needs to be better lines of communication as well. That's something that we're hoping to work on. We do have quite a few meetings with the GMC lined up going forwards.
In your research and just in your general conversations, have you come across people where they have been told of the allegation and heard from their perspective on what did they do and what did they say and what did they think they could and couldn't do? Say, for instance, if I was your boss and you came to me, do you talk to the me's? You talk to the line managers? Is there an opportunity to speak to those people to understand what are you doing? And if you don't pursue it, what is it? There's a risk involved, isn't there? A professional risk. Like, these are people's jobs.
Yeah. Becky and I were actually in Birmingham yesterday doing some training for the TPDs of NHS West Midlands, speaking to TPDs from all the different specialties in the area. And we had a real big conversation about this. So we were talking about how to respond to someone disclosing an incident to you. And we give them tips and tricks about, you know, make sure that you're in a safe environment, be understanding, all those kind of things. But then we get to a difficulty of what do they do going forwards? Again, it's the fact that they're often going to be told about one of their colleagues that's perpetrating, and that's difficult for them because do they have the training, the skills to have those conversations one-on-one, or do they then have to highlight it to their HR department? What is their policy locally? Because there is going to be huge variation from trust to trust to trust. And this is before we even take primary care into consideration, because obviously that's a whole different story altogether. But what we do know from the research and the data out there, so the BMJ and the Guardian did a joint investigation and report that was published, I want to say in October, that found that only 10% of NHS trusts in England have a sexual misconduct policy. So that means 90% of hospitals in England do not have a policy on this. So what is meant to happen? If there is a disclosure, what is meant to happen? No one knows. We've got resources and examples of good practice and what we want to see in trusts, but we're a long way off from making that standard practice within England or the UK as a whole, unfortunately.
Looking at some of your recommended actions, one of them is an independent inquiry into the culture of sexism and sexual misconduct in healthcare. Now, how many surveys and reports need to be written? Because it's not going to be anything surprising, is there? Because people have done the work and it's recent, it's not historic. I'm sure there is lots of historic stuff. This is current. So why would you like an independent inquiry done?
I totally agree with you in terms of there are surveys happening. There is work being done in this area. But in order to bring about change and to speak to change makers, we need that data. We need that evidence. We also need to know how much this is costing. And I don't mean just in legal cases. I mean in days of sickness or absence from work because of stress, etc. And at the moment, the data that's out there, yes, we have some contemporaneous data, but it's very doctor-centric and it's very surgeon-centric. Whereas actually, in terms of the healthcare workforce, that's not the majority. The majority is with our nursing colleagues and HCAs, etc. So we'd like there to be an independent inquiry because, one, it'll be hopefully very thorough, it'll hopefully be adequately funded, and then that's done at a national parliamentary level. That is then already going to have the links in the infrastructure to hopefully bring about change. You know, that's why we've ended up in Parliament over these past few weeks.
Are your 9 recommendations, you know, like running alongside each other? Or do you have like, okay, in 2024, we're really going to try and focus on X?
I think ideally they'd all be running alongside each other. This all goes back to culture. So the culture of tolerance, the culture of sexism, etc. happening. And that's the hardest thing to change in any organisation. And the NHS is huge. the NHS is absolutely massive. So to change that culture, ideally, everything would be happening all at once. And we as an organisation are a grassroots organisation. But equally, we've gone straight to the top. We've gone to the employers, we've gone to the Royal Colleges, the training schools, we've gone to universities, so from an undergraduate level, because it just needs attacking from all angles, basically, to try and get the biggest change as quick as possible. And I'm very realistic in that I know that when I say quick as possible, it's probably going to be at least 10, 15 years until we probably see something that is significantly different.
Do you have any mentors behind the scenes supporting you?
No, not really. I keep saying, I don't know where me and Becky get the audacity to do any of this stuff, really, if I'm honest.
Well, it's great. I think not that you need it. It's just a question. It's not to say that you do need it.
Yeah, it's a question that keeps cropping up every so often. There's definitely individuals who we look up to and who we respect who are doing work in this area. I'm thinking about Professor Carrie Newlands and Miss Tamsin Cumming, who've been behind the Breaking the Silence report with the Royal College of Surgeons. We look at what they've done and what they've achieved, and that's really impressive and we admire that. But there's differences in the way that Becky and I are coming from this, because we are not affiliated with, well, I am affiliated clinically with a Royal College, as is Becky. But in terms of this stuff and this work, we are completely independent. And we are earlier on in our careers, which I think some people might think that as a weakness, but actually I feel that it's our strength. I'm a registrar, Becky is a qualified GP. We are senior enough that we've worked in healthcare long enough to know what the issues are, but I feel that we're junior enough that we are approachable. So we have volunteers behind the scenes, and a lot of them are medical students, and they feel that they can come and talk to us about their experiences and what's been going on and what they can do. So there are elements in terms of mentors and people that we look up to. We don't have anything official, as it were.
At the time of recording, so it's the 15th of December, although this won't come out for a while, it's a junior doctor strikes coming, I think next week or the week after.
Yeah.
Pay disputes. What about the career progression? Now you've got this. It's like, what would you be saying to somebody? We're trying to recruit and retain people that want to do medicine and keep them in the UK. You must have friends going, I'm thinking of this, or like, what do I do when I qualify? Like, what are you telling them?
I got asked this question recently. I was at a conference at Cambridge Uni, which sounds very la-di-da.
the other day when I was just...
Yeah, I know. It was for sixth formers who were wanting to apply to medicine example. And there was a 16-year-old in the audience, and she said, what would you say to me now? And there are issues. At this point, I'd already given my spiel about like how horrific the sexism issues were. I was like, there are issues, there are. But healthcare isn't exempt. It isn't a special case. I think it feels more uncomfortable because you assume that people that go into the NHS, into healthcare, are there to look after other people. So you just assume that everyone is good and lovely and has all these virtuous qualities. But actually, everyone that works in healthcare is still human. Therefore, there are bad apples, there are bad people. Is that more than any other industry? We don't know for certain, but probably not. And actually, I love my job. I love my clinical job. I go to work every day. Well, when I'm back at work, I'll go to work every day. I will make a real connection with a patient or with a family, either to give them good news that they just need a prescription, they can go home, or to say, I'm really sorry, you need to come in, you're not very well. I get to do what I train to do at med school. I take a history, I examine, I do investigations, I make a diagnosis, and then I make a bit of a plan. And then in theory, they're meant to go off to a ward, but obviously that doesn't happen anymore. And it's great. And it's just, I don't think I would get that sense of fulfillment in any other job ever, anywhere. So I think it's great. And I do encourage people to follow their passion into healthcare. I think it needs to be a really informed decision, because anyone that comes into medicine for the money is not smart. Don't get me wrong, you need money to pay the bills, but that can't be what
I love you that need. You are not smart.
If that's why you've gone into healthcare, for money, well, particularly emergency medicine, like, it's not smart. You know, it should be for fulfillment and for those kind of reasons. I think that's just my ideology, I guess.
So as a result of somebody listening to this podcast, if they were only to do one thing, what would you want that one thing to be?
I would like you to go onto our website and read the stories and just familiarise yourself with surviving in scrubs, who we are, what we do. There are loads of resources on our website in terms of talking about these themes, these issues, but also for support as well. And if people feel that they have a story or they feel comfortable to share a story, if they could do that on our website, that would be fantastic. Because everything that Becky and I have accomplished, everything we've achieved, just everything that we've done in these past 18 months is because of these testimonies, because of this collective narrative, and because of everyone who's been generous enough and brave enough to share their stories with us. That would be the one thing that I would ask people.
Okay, I'll leave the link in the show notes. And I just want to say thank you so, so much for coming on.
Oh, no worries. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you like what you hear, I would absolutely love it if you left us an iTunes rating and 5-star review. I know many of you give us a shout out on social media, which is lovely to see you guys listening to the podcast. So please come and find us on Twitter at THC Primary Care, on Instagram and on LinkedIn. Just look for Tara Humphrey. And if you're not subscribed to our newsletter, please do. You get to hear more insights, more confessions, some tips and tools, and a roundup of our activity over the week. So click on join the newsletter in the show notes, and I will see you in the next episode.